Hello, good evening. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Tonight, I will be your host as we talk about the autoimmune disease known as lupus. May is Lupus Awareness Month, and World Lupus Day is tomorrow, May 10. It's a time to help people become more aware of this very important illness and its effects on patients and their families. Tonight, let's go ahead and meet the guests that we have who have joined us here in the studio.
My name is Rolanda Hewitt.
And I'm Dr. Mamta Katikneni.
All right. Well, Ro and Dr. K, welcome to you guys both for joining us tonight on Health Matters.
Thank you so much.
Dr. K, first of all, tell us a little bit about your position at LSU. I understand you're on faculty there.
Yes, I'm an assistant professor of rheumatology at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport. And I've been at LSU, affiliated with LSU for the past 10 years.
And I understand you're in the division of rheumatology, correct?
Yes.
So rheumatology deals with these types of illnesses. How does one train and become educated to be a rheumatologist?
So I went to med school, following which I did an internal medicine residency, which sort of lays the foundation for rheumatology, which is a three-year residency program. And I did 2 years of training in rheumatology fellowship. Everything was done here at LSU Shreveport.
Is that standard for the rheumatology fellowship to be 2 years?
It is a two-year fellowship, okay. Unless you want to do an additional third year of research.
Okay, so 2 years beyond 3 years of internal medicine, so 5 years after medical school. So that's a lot of education.
That is.
So thank you for being here. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you so much.
Ro, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your involvement with this disease known as lupus.
Well, I'm one of the founding members of our Tammy Fleming Walk to End Lupus Foundation. We offer or have a walk every single year. This is our seventh year, and it started 7 years ago when a very close friend of mine passed away from lupus. Her niece, Tangela Sylvie, who was one of the founders as well, and her mother, Tangela's mother, who is Rosie Hampton, she's one of the founders as well. And they had this great idea to have a walk just to kind of pay tribute to Tammy and to honor her. And so many lupus warriors, as we call them, which are lupus patients, they were really excited about it and wanted us to continue. So 7 years later, here we are.
Now, from the standpoint of your involvement, when does the walk take place?
Well, this walk this year is going to be May 18th. And it's going to be at Columbia Park, which is 2900 Cresswell Avenue, which is right down the street from Bird. It's on the corner of Cresswell and Kings Highway.
And how do people find out more information about that? Is there a website or
yes,
somewhere
sir.
They can go?
Okay. We do have a website. It's RTF Walk to End Lupus, and we also have a Facebook page with the same name. And they can look on Facebook or either go to our website and find out more information about it.
And how long is the walk?
It's from 9 to 12.
Okay.
It's just a little winding path. It's okay. Not like a 5K or anything like that.
Okay.
Because a lot of lupus patients have, you know, some issues with walking. We decided to have it at Columbia Park because we understand that lupus patients do not need to be out in the sun. So it has lots of shading. So we were very strategic in deciding to have it there. This year, LSU Health reached out to us. And so now we're not sure what we're going to get this year, so I don't know if it'll be there next year or not, but definitely this year it is at Columbia Park.
And will there be other healthcare entities involved as well that will be there to provide information or resources for people who are interested in learning more about lupus?
LSU is providing all of those doctors and nurses and physical therapists, so I can let Dr. K talk a little bit more about that.
Sure, yeah, Dr. K.
Yeah, the Center of Excellence of Rheumatology at LSU is going to have its presence there, including all of us physicians, fellows, residents interested in rheumatology. We're going to have a physical therapist come do the warm-up before the walk, and we're going to be having a lot of information to give out during the walk.
Oh, wow. Very, very good information. So May 18th.
Yes.
9 o'clock in the morning until
yes.
noon.
Yes.
In Columbia Park, that's off of Kings Highway.
Yes.
It's actually the same place they do the Highland Blues Festival, correct? Jazz and Blues Festival.
I'm not sure.
For those listeners out there who have attended that event, so this is in a similar location. Very, very nice part of town.
Yeah.
A lot of shade, as you mentioned.
Yes.
So thank you so much for that important information about the Tammy Fleming Walk to in Lupus.
Yes, and it's free registration. We have not charged anyone anything. However, we ask, if they would like to donate anything to keep it going. That's definitely a plus for us, and we encourage people to do that. But it is free registration. There will be other vendors out there, as well as just different organizations stopping by. Some will have a table and pass out information about jobs, about health, and things like that. The fire department is going to be there, probably the police department as well. So we hope to have a great time. There'll be live entertainment, and there's a DJ, and yeah.
Oh, excellent. So it sounds like a festival. Excellent. Dr. K, from the standpoint of, we've talked about how important lupus is, but if we could maybe back up just a little bit and explain to our listeners, if you will, what lupus is.
So lupus derives its name from a Greek word, wolf, which speaks to the aggressiveness of the nature of the disease. Lupus is an autoimmune disease, which means autoimmune, that is your immune system fighting against your own body. And it's a chronic disease, which means once you get lupus, it's there to stay. So it's not something that you can recover from really quick. It stays on for months and years. So lupus is an autoimmune chronic disease where you have inflammation in literally any part of the body. It can affect any organ in the body and cause inflammation because the immune system is fighting against the own body.
And so you mentioned that it can invade or affect any organ in the body. What's the most common presentation if someone's out there and they don't know what lupus is and they might have it, for example? How would they know?
So lupus is really called the great mimicker because it can present with symptoms in any organ or any part of the body, as I mentioned earlier, and it mimics a number of other diseases like infections and cancer. So if you have symptoms that are unexplained by any other cause, most commonly including the skin, like a skin rash, hair loss, ulcers in the mouth or the nose, arthritis, which is swelling and pain in joints, and it can involve the internal organs like the kidney, the heart, the lung. So lupus is really a diagnosis made by a physician based on the presentation of autoimmunity after ruling out all the other more common diseases. So it's a process of excluding all the other possibilities and then attributing it to autoimmunity.
And from the standpoint of sunlight, Ro mentioned, this event is going to be in the shade. And so is photosensitivity something that you see very early in this illness, or is it something that occurs later on?
Photosensitivity is a common presentation or a common symptom of lupus where patients, if they are out in the sun, can have increased sensitivity of their skin, so they develop a rash, which does not go away by itself like a sunburn. It stays on, lingers on, and it needs to be treated. So photosensitivity is because of the UV radiation, ultraviolet radiation of the sun. The ultraviolet rays break down the skin cells causing the rash, but also in addition to just causing the rash, the cells that are broken down are what stimulates the immune system to produce what we call antibodies, which are the warriors of the immune system. And these antibodies go bind to antigen, which are our normal cells, and cause inflammation. So it is this interaction between the antigen and the warriors, that is the antibodies, that causes inflammation not just in the skin, but also in every organ in the body. So sun exposure can cause lupus rash as well as a lupus flare internally.
And, since the sun is finally out today and, it's probably time to start thinking about wearing our sunscreen.
That's right.
How would you tell the difference between, a lupus rash or a rash that could indicate autoimmune disease from just a regular sunburn? How would you know the difference?
It takes a trained eye to look at it, to differentiate just a sunburn from a lupus rash. Most likely a lupus rash will not get better. A sunburn may get better by itself without needing any intervention, but a lupus rash will not. And it's more so the correlation of the skin rash with other symptoms that make you think about lupus. So the most common rash in lupus is called the butterfly rash or the malar rash, which is like butterfly's wings on the cheek. And if you see that kind of a rash, it most likely is lupus. But lupus can also cause rash in all the other parts of the body. So it's the correlation of the rash with other symptoms.
And protection from the rash, is it possible for people, obviously avoiding sun is, you know, one of the main things that you can do to avoid ultraviolet light, but the rest of us, we use sunscreen when we go out in the sun. Is that helpful for lupus patients to use sunscreen as well, or is this illness resistant to your typical sun protection?
Definitely using sunscreen is one of the biggest steps in preventing lupus. We don't know what causes lupus, but we know that sun exposure makes it worse. So the number one thing I tell all of my patients is use sunscreen every single time before you step out of the house. Sunscreen by itself is not enough. You need to cover up as much as you can. Wear hats, use an umbrella, try and avoid being out in the sun. But a big misconception about the photosensitivity is that the UV radiation is there only when the sun is out. That is not true. UV radiation passes through the clouds as well. So on a cloudy day like it was yesterday, when you spend time outdoors, you still need to protect yourself and use sunscreen. The sunscreen that we recommend is an SPF of more than 30. The higher the number, the better it is. It provides more protection from the UV radiation.
All right. This is Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and you are invited to ask us questions about our topic tonight, which is lupus. The number for those questions, if you have them, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Radio. Ro, from the standpoint of the lupus walk, will you be providing information to people with the foundation that's there that have questions about how to get tested for lupus?
Absolutely. And LSU is really contributing a lot towards that this year. They will not have a full-on health fair, but they will be there to answer questions, possibly to take some blood pressures, and just kind of talk about symptoms of lupus, just things to kind of help the families out for their family members that have lupus. We'll have some things in their goodie bags as far as things that they need to remember or look for as knowing that you possibly might have lupus or just how to treat yourself.
Okay, great information. Again, this is listener-supported Red River Radio. Our number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Our topic tonight is lupus. You know, one of the things that comes up, you mentioned you exclude other illnesses whenever the diagnosis or presentation of lupus comes about. One of the things that we hear about is that sometimes an infection can initiate lupus or flare lupus in certain individuals. What types of infections can actually cause lupus?
Actually, to this point, we don't know what kind of infections causes, or we don't know if there is a known cause for lupus. But most of the time it is noticed that it can be triggered by any kind of bacterial or viral infection. Any kind of stress to the body can trigger lupus if they have the genetic risk factors for lupus. What are these genetic risk factors? We don't know yet, but any kind of stress to the body in the form of an infection can trigger it.
And do you think it's more likely to be a viral infection that triggers lupus as opposed to, we know Viruses can do lots of weird things when it comes to autoimmunity, correct? We have Epstein-Barr-related issues, things along those lines. Do we think that certain viruses, as opposed to maybe a bacterial infection, could be responsible?
It is more common with viral infections because of molecular mimicry, which means that the virus tricks our immune system into creating cells that fight against our own body. So a viral infection, in addition to causing stress to the body, will also trigger the immune system and cause autoimmunity that can trigger and cause the lupus.
And the other thing is, drug-induced lupus. Is that the situation that most people have that get lupus, or is this very uncommon, actually?
Drug-induced lupus is rather uncommon, but maybe under-recognized, because if you see the drugs that can cause drug-induced lupus, some of them are blood pressure medication, some of them are fluid pills, and these pills are very commonly used. But drug-induced lupus is rare compared to the systemic lupus or the discoid lupus that we see in usual. Drug-induced lupus most of the time is because of a drug, and they develop symptoms of lupus, and if you stop the drug, the symptoms of lupus go away. And that is a way to differentiate if it is drug-induced lupus or systemic lupus.
All right. Very good information. We're going to get, further and further down the road of really explaining lupus tonight. But before we do, we have another guest that's joined us. Let's have her introduce herself.
My name is Livette Bell.
Hi, Livette. Thank you for coming and joining us on Health Matters tonight.
Likewise.
What brings you here tonight to join us?
Well, I come to, talk about the afterlife of lupus.
So when you say afterlife, what do you mean by after the diagnosis?
Well, after I've gotten a kidney transplant.
Okay.
And, the life after that.
So, you have lupus? I'm making an assumption.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
All right. And it affected your kidney, your
yes.
biologic kidneys. And
yes.
How did you find out that you had lupus?
Well, I would get they say my blood was trying to come out any way that it could, and I got sores in my mouth and red spots over my legs, and it took them a couple years to figure it out, but after maybe 6 or 7 they figured that's what it was.
So 6 or 7, you had symptoms for 6 or 7 years before they were able to make the diagnosis?
Yes.
And how long have you had lupus for now?
Now I've had lupus for 12 years.
And you mentioned the afterlife, so how are you doing with things now?
Absolutely great.
That's remarkable. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story of lupus with us, and we'll have some more things to talk to you about as we move forward in the program.
Yes.
I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. We're talking about lupus, and our number for questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. K, I understand besides maybe post-infectious or drug-induced lupus, there are other types of lupus like discoid lupus versus systemic lupus. Are those the same disease presenting in different ways, or are they two different diseases?
I would say they are the same spectrum of disease. Discoid lupus can develop into systemic lupus. So let me start by explaining what these terms mean. Discoid lupus, as the name suggests, there are disc-like skin rash. Disc-like or scarring rash on the face, on the body, on the scalp. And this skin rash on the scalp can cause what we call alopecia, which means hair loss, because the scarring scars over the hair follicle and hair doesn't grow once the follicle is scarred. So it's a scarring kind of skin rash that can happen anywhere in the body. And these patients with just pure discoid lupus do not have internal organ involvement. It's just superficial on the skin. Systemic lupus, on the other hand, as the name suggests, systemic means it's all over the body. So there is inflammation in the skin as well as inside the body. Discoid lupus over years can evolve or turn into systemic lupus, and or it can stay just as it is as discoid lupus with the skin involvement only.
Are there certain types of people or populations that are at risk for lupus? Do we see it equally in, you know, different cultural situations geographically?
So for whatever reason, we don't know yet, but lupus is common in African-American patients and Hispanic patients, less common in the other ethnicities, but it is 2 to 3 times more common in these racial groups. So significant incidence of lupus in our state here.
And in terms of overall across the country, are we seeing that the numbers of people that develop lupus is relatively stable? Is it going down or is it increasing?
I think it keeps increasing because as awareness is increased, you recognize and diagnose lupus more than before. So the incidence keeps increasing, the number keeps rising. And per the latest statistics, there are 16,000 new patients diagnosed every year. So the number keeps adding on. And once you're diagnosed with lupus, you have lupus. It's not something that you can, it may be in remission, which means it may not be active, but it never resolves. So the total number of lupus patients keeps rising.
Okay, well, that sounds like, you know, something that we really need to be aware of. Obviously, that's why we have a, you know, worldwide Lupus Recognition Day. From the standpoint, Ms. Bell, when you had, you know, your first symptoms, I know it's been, you know, 12 years or so. Do you remember what you were feeling the first time you felt like maybe something was not right, that it, you know, triggered you to go and see a provider?
Yes, actually my back started hurting and I wasn't able to walk. And from there, it went to blisters on my feet. And that's what actually made me go into the hospital.
Okay, blisters on the skin. Is that a common presentation, Dr. K?
The blisters is a rarer form of lupus, what we call bullous lupus. And it is really rare. It's not the common skin rash that we see with lupus. But once you see blisters and you see other symptoms of lupus, you know that the blisters is because of lupus.
And she mentions, you know, that it took, you know, maybe even 6 or 7 years for the diagnosis to really be confirmed. Is that common? Is it challenging to make the diagnosis of lupus?
Unfortunately, it is very, very challenging, and it is common to take 6 to 7 years. A major study found that more than 50% of patients, it took 6 years just to diagnose that they had lupus. This is despite them getting medical attention. And more than 50% of them had seen 4 or 5 doctors already before the diagnosis was made. So that is the most frustrating part about lupus, is patients are suffering with it for many, many years before you can have a name to the disease and you can start treating it. And unfortunately, if you start treating later on in the disease course, the damage is done because of the inflammation. So that's why we want to create awareness about lupus, is to get people to think about it, get doctors to think about it, get referred to a rheumatologist early if you have any concern or symptoms of lupus.
Yeah, it is called the disease of 1,000 faces, because, I mean, who would think that I have a headache would mean I need to go to the doctor because I possibly will, you know, may have lupus. So yeah, it hides itself in other ways.
From the standpoint of pain, you know, Ms. Bell mentioned that she had back pain, which is nearly universal in terms of, you know, the human experience. Most people are going to suffer back pain at some point in their lives. Is there something about pain and lupus that's different than a typical headache, a typical migraine, or a typical backache?
Unfortunately, pain is the most common and the most frustrating symptom that patients have with lupus, because it's difficult to explain this pain. Other people don't see the pain. The pain is not tangible. So pain is a big part of patients with lupus's life. The pain in lupus is more constant. the arthritis or the joint pain happens more early in the morning, and patients will notice that they are more stiff, that their joints are tight or stuck or really stiff in the morning. And as the day goes by, the pain gets better. But if the patient has swelling in addition to the pain, that is important. That indicates inflammation. Swelling is a sign of inflammation. So the correlation of all of these symptoms with maybe skin rash or maybe sores in the mouth or maybe inflammation in the body will point towards lupus. But just having back pain is not enough to ask your doctor to check you for lupus. It's more so the other unexplained symptoms that go with it.
About, you know, what age do your typical lupus patients present? I see where it can even occur in childhood. What's yes. the most common age that you see with the presentation of lupus?
The most common age for lupus is, for whatever reason, in the childbearing years. So maybe between 15 years to 40, but lupus can commonly be seen up to 15 to 65 years of age. 15% of patients can be children. So lupus can affect children from any age, even from when they are born all the way into their teenage years. So it's rare, but can happen to see, can happen that children have lupus.
You know, you mentioned that women of childbearing age can present with lupus. And obviously, you know, when women become pregnant and they already have lupus, can they pass lupus on to their child?
So I will say yes and no. They can pass lupus on to their child in a way that the antibodies, which I mentioned earlier were warriors of the immune system, can go through the placenta into the baby's circulation and cause lupus in the baby, what we call neonatal lupus. Neonatal lupus can be in the form of a skin rash on the baby when the baby is born, or low blood counts in the baby when the baby is born. But this kind of lupus is just because of the mom's blood cells circulating in the baby. In a few months, the mother's blood cells are destroyed, and then the baby will no longer have lupus. So neonatal lupus is more so because of the mother's blood cells that passively go through into the baby's circulation.
Again, this is Health Matters. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. We are discussing lupus. The number for calls or comments regarding this topic is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Ms. Bell, whenever you received your diagnosis, you know, what, you know, how did that go for you? I know you probably were hoping that you would get news it was going to be something easy to fix, right? So when you got your diagnosis, what did that, how did that go for you?
Well, it was kind of frustrating because I was getting ready to graduate college. Well, not college, high school. And it took a toll on my life. So all of the activities that I was used to doing, I couldn't do anymore. And it just kind of stopped my life. That's the way I feel, you know.
Ro, when you I know you've talked to a lot of these patients that suffer with lupus. What are some of the things that you hear about the most in terms of how it affects their, you know, their daily lives?
It's an array of things that I hear, but fatigue is a big one. Definitely staying out of the sun, issues from being in the sun and UV rays. The medications that they have to take. Some are taking tons of medications. And the pain. The pain would be the top. Yeah. And we just try to link up one lupus patient with another and with another so that they could have, you know, support for each other and also share information about doctors and things that they do to help themselves.
Peer support. Let's talk more about that, because there, I'm suspecting, are probably groups that people can get hooked into to go and maybe talk to other patients who have lupus. But we've got a caller.
Hello,
this is Dr. Randall Brewer. You're on Health Matters. Thank you for calling this evening.
Thank you for having me, doctor. I had a question about where we see the cases of lupus, I guess, show up. And the doctor explained that they saw it show up more so in the African American cultures and then the Hispanic. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, my question is, do you see it more so in just the African American, or have they done the research in the African, like, communities overseas, or is it just African American? Does that make sense?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I think what you're trying to ask is if if the data could be skewed in terms of if the research was done in a predominantly African American population. But no, ma'am,
versus
this is based on
African,
even
versus people from Africa.
Africa. Okay.
Yeah.
No, the data was done all over the country, all over the world, and the numbers are the same. And even in our practice here in northwestern part of Louisiana, we see that majority of the patients that we have are African Americans or Hispanic. And for whatever reason, it just affects these ethnicities more.
And so then in Africa, when you did the study, was it a certain, was it a certain tribe that the cases showed up more so, or?
I'm sorry, ma'am. I do not have data about Africa. I haven't reviewed those studies, so I will not be able to answer. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's okay. That helps me out a lot, but thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for calling us. Again, our number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. So, Ro, you were mentioning, you know, you try to, you know, link patients with lupus up to each other so they can talk about things that are going on in their lives. How do patients find those resources? Obviously, the walk is important. That's something that happens once a year. But let's say someone who's not able to get to the walk or lives a long distance away, how would patients with lupus connect to other individuals?
Well, there's contact information on our website, and we actually had an initial support group meeting about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and just, you know, let the patients know and their families that, you know, we wanted to start it, and if they wanted to continue with it, they could. And they did it for a little bit and then just kind of disbanded, and then a few people started one here, a few people started one there. And so whenever people reach out to us on Facebook or on our website, we definitely point them in the direction of those that are still having them. They're small groups, but they still exist. And then LSU, Dr. K can talk a little bit about one that they are starting.
Yeah, we are in the process of starting a support group on behalf of LSU Rheumatology, where we're going to pick a topic and meet the first Saturday of every month, starting in June. We are going to put up information on the website and the Facebook group, as Ro mentioned. But we hope to get experts from different fields to come talk about lupus. We are hoping to get a lot of patients to exchange their stories and basically give each other moral support.
Excellent. Is there a website for the rheumatology division that might have information regarding that people can look to go to in the future?
It's still a work in progress. Unfortunately, I don't have the website link to give out right now, but we are going to update it on the Tammy Fleming Walk to End Lupus website.
Excellent information. Ms. Bell, from your standpoint, you hear us talking about different groups that people can be affiliated with who have lupus. Has that been part of your recovery with the illness that you've experienced?
This will be my first year doing it.
Doing the walk?
Doing the walk and actually getting into groups. I've seen it before, but I was kind of not able to attend, so this will actually be my first year to participate with the lupus walk and try and get in the different type of groups.
Are you looking forward to it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right.
Absolutely.
Especially, I can tell from your, you know, the big smile on your face. You guys listening out there can't see that, but she's great big smile on her face. I could see how you could be just a tremendous resource for people who need hope, who are having, you know, difficulty dealing maybe early in the diagnosis and thinking, oh, you know, my life's over. This is terrible. I have to go to doctors for the rest of my life, and I have to take terrible medications. You know, what you guys are doing can be tremendously uplifting and provide a lot of hope for individuals who are just not really dealing very well with
a new
diagnosis.
Yeah, and a lot of them, they don't really want people to know that they have lupus. There are so many that we've met that a family member's told us about, our friend, and we've approached them and talked to them about it and shared information with them, but they're a little hesitant to come out and let people know they have it. So we just want them to know that there are other people out there that know what you're going through, and they would be a great resource for you, or a great friend, you know, someone to just talk to when you just need to talk, because I might not understand what you mean when you say that I'm in pain, or I'm swollen, my ankles are swollen, or my muscles are swollen or achy. And whereas she would, you know, Miss Bell would. So it's just, you know, come out and enjoy each other, meet each other, and be a support for each other.
Miss Bell, you know, from your experience, you know, was that something that, you know, you struggled with, perhaps, was, you know, allowing other people to know about what you were going through?
Yes, it was a really big struggle. I don't like a lot of sympathy, so I hid. You know, I hid on the inside. It was just me and my family. I didn't want it to get out. But in the end, you know, and I tried to stay positive so I wouldn't have to let anyone know. And yes, it was a very big struggle.
Well, look how far you've come. So thank you again for being here with us. This is listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and the program you're listening to is Health Matters. Our topic tonight is lupus. You can call us with a question or comment. We've got a little bit more time for those. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Okay, Dr. K, we've talked quite a bit about what lupus is, and, you know, some of the elements of how you diagnose it based on symptoms. Before we get into treatment, I know there's a really popular blood test that you probably hate to hear about people ordering to see if they have lupus. Tell us about the dreaded ANA blood test, and where does it fit into the spectrum of diagnostic things that rheumatologists go through to assess for this disease?
Sure. So the ANA is a test called anti-nuclear antibody, and it is in fact the most common test ordered, especially if a patient complains of pain or has a skin rash, because lupus is something that no doctor wants to miss. And ANA is a blood test which is looking for the antibodies. As I was mentioning earlier, antibodies are produced by our immune system that causes or triggers all of this inflammation. So ANA is these antibodies checked for in the blood. Unfortunately, ANA is not a very sensitive test, which means there are a number of patients that can have the ANA come back positive without having the disease or without ever developing the disease. And that's why ANA is coming back positive does not mean that you have lupus. It just means that you have autoantibodies, antibodies that are in your blood circulation that may or may not cause any damage. So if you have all the right symptoms, which is multiple organs inflamed without any other reason to explain it, talk to your primary care doctor and get your ANA checked. The ANA titer, which is the test result that comes back in terms of numbers, gives us more information if it could just be a false positive, which means the test is positive but you do not have lupus, or a true positive, which means the titer is so high that we cannot ignore it, that you may develop lupus in the future. So having an ANA of 1:40 or 1:80 is a very, very likely false positive ANA. The biggest problem with ANA is majority of patients have this low titer and they get labeled with the diagnosis of lupus, which is something that does not serve any good either to the patient or the doctor. Because being labeled with a permanent or chronic diagnosis like lupus means you may be treated with medication that you do not need. These medications are not without side effects. So labeling it or mislabeling the diagnosis when it may be something else all along that could be very easily treated and cured, mislabeling it as lupus is one of the biggest mistakes that we do, which is why we want to raise awareness about just having a positive test does not mean you have lupus. It's more, it's just one piece of the puzzle. We need to look at the entire picture, look at all the other symptoms before diagnosing a patient with lupus. And as we already know, a diagnosis like lupus comes with a lot of morbidity, a lot of depression, a lot of other significant changes in a person's life, as Ms. Bell said. So we need to be careful while making this diagnosis.
So you mentioned the false positive. Is it possible to have a little bit of lupus with a low titer positive ANA, or is it a sort of you either have it or you don't situation?
It's either you have it or you don't, because you could have mild symptoms of lupus, but it still is lupus. The titer of the ANA does not correlate with the severity of symptoms. So that's another thing I want to talk about, is you could have really, really bad lupus, but your ANA may be a low positive titer. So that's why we take the titer in correlation with the other symptoms when we make a diagnosis of lupus.
And so moving forward to treatment, do you use that titer to monitor the success of treatment? I'm seeing a shaking head. No. So how do we treat lupus then if we're not going to use the titer to monitor how people are doing? How do we know if they're better?
So checking the titer or checking the ANA is just one part of diagnosing it, but we do not use it to treat, because once the ANA is positive, it's going to remain positive. So the treatment really depends on the symptoms that the patient is having. If the patient is having a rash, we treat the rash until the rash resolves. If the patient is having inflammation in the kidney, we treat that till they don't spill any more protein or they don't have any more blood in their urine. If the inflammation is in their lungs, till their lungs clear up based on a CAT scan or based on a chest X-ray. If the inflammation is in their bone marrow, we monitor their cell counts, which is the hemoglobin, the white count, and the platelet count, till they normalize. So basically, the treatment depends on what organ is involved, what symptoms they are having, and we monitor those symptoms. At the same time, we are constantly looking or on the lookout for other organs being involved. So a patient may just have skin lupus, but we always monitor their urine, monitor their cell counts, because at any point it can cause inflammation in those organs.
What are the most common things that can trigger a flare-up of lupus? And maybe, Ms. Bell, you can tell us, you know, what your experience was or is whenever you have indications that your lupus is maybe bothering you.
I would say the UV rays from the sun, maybe any kind of cold illness, stress. That's mainly, you know, everything that I've seen to trigger it. So
infections, things like viruses,
yes,
and then high stress situations. Yes. Dr. K, is there anything that someone like Ms. Bell, if they know they have the diagnosis, are there things that they can do? We've talked a lot about sun protection. Are there any other things that they can do to help prevent a flare-up?
Yes, definitely. I think the biggest thing that a patient with lupus can do to help themselves is talk to their doctor, talk to their rheumatologist about any new symptoms, about any questions. And the second biggest thing they can do is take their medication. Most of these patients are on anywhere between 2 to 20 or even more medication. It's medication that they have to take multiple times a day for months and years together. So I recognize that it's not easy to take your medication all the time, day in and day out, especially when some of these medication make you feel bad and cause side effects. But if you don't take your medication, the inflammation is going to get worse. And what these medications do is they suppress or cut down the immune system, cut down the inflammation. So it is very, very important to take medication without missing or without ignoring the doctor's advice about medication.
And you mentioned there's, you know, anywhere from 2 to 20 medications they could be taking. What are the most common medications that are used to treat lupus?
So the most common medicine that is used initially to treat lupus when lupus is really aggressive is prednisone, which is a steroid. And prednisone is the quickest way to cut down the inflammation in the body when it is really active. So during a bad flare, prednisone is the number one medicine we use. However, prednisone has a whole lot of side effects, and that's why we try to use other medications that are safer, I would say, than prednisone, so they don't experience the side effects but still have the benefit of decreased inflammation in the body. So apart from prednisone, depending on what organ is involved, we have medication like methotrexate, Imuran, Cellcept, Areva, our tablets, which we can use if it is inflammation in the skin, inflammation in the muscles, inflammation in the joints. If it's mainly inflammation in the kidneys and inflammation in the brain, which is the most deadliest and biggest complication with lupus, we have to use IV medication, chemotherapy kind of medication, like Cytoxan or cyclophosphamide, or Rituxan or rituximab. These medication really are reserved for the really sick patients. And we use them in addition to prednisone to help decrease the inflammation. Benlysta or belimumab is the only FDA-approved medication to treat lupus. And that medicine is really good. It's an IV medication given once a month, and it's good to help reduce the skin rash and the joint pain related to lupus.
And so it's a MAB drug, so I'm thinking it's a monoclonal antibody.
That is correct.
Do we know which type of antibodies it works against?
So it really affects the B cells, and the B cells or B lymphocytes are cells in our body that produce these antibodies. So it does not target any particular antibody, but it decreases the survival of B cells. Hence, maybe the B cells will produce less antibody. Hence, maybe there'll be less inflammation.
And it sounds to me like the most common denominator amongst all of these drugs is it lowers the functionality of the immune system, correct? So autoimmunity is reduced, but also I'm assuming healthy immunity is reduced as well. So can you talk to us a little bit, maybe, Belle, you're smiling again. Can you talk to us a little bit about, does the treatment of lupus set people up to have more infections than usual?
I would say no. Everything that I've been through, like she was saying, the Cytoxan, I've taken that also in the beginning, and it really helped me. It was nothing that they gave me set up anything worse. Everything was perfect.
Was there one particular medication? You mentioned Cytoxan. Was there any other particular medications that you felt like were important in your recovery?
Yes, the prednisone. It actually calms the inflammation. And the Plaquenil, I can't really remember much about the Plaquenil, but the prednisone, it's great.
All right. And from the standpoint of, you know, going forward in the future, what would you say, maybe if we were, you know, sitting here again in 10 years, what would we be talking about in terms of the research that is going on now that could produce other treatments for lupus going forward, Dr. K?
Well, I think the biggest questions with lupus is why. Why do people get it? What causes it? What makes one person get it, whereas the next person not? So I hope research in the next 10, 15 years answers this big question of why. The other big thing that I'm hopeful for is a lot more medication. We just have one FDA-approved medicine as of now. We do use a whole lot of other medicines because we've seen that it works, but I hope for more research in terms of more medication to treat with lesser side effects. And the side effects is a big part of all of these medicines. As you had mentioned earlier, increased risk of infection because the immune system is being cut down. But apart from that, a lot of these medicines have other side effects like nausea, vomiting, affecting the cell counts in the body. So medication that have few side effects but very effective and easy to take for the patient, easy on the patient, is really what we are hoping for with lupus.
Again, this is Dr. Randall Brewer. We have maybe time for one more call or question. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. This is Health Matters, and the topic tonight is lupus. Ro, let's go back to the walk for a little bit. From what I understand, there's a $1,000 R. Tammy Fleming Scholarship that can be applied for up until May 13. Tell us about the scholarship.
Well, we wanted to do something special for the students. It's not just a walk for awareness. We wanted to be able to help families that may be going through a trying time, or just to encourage those students that are trying to further their careers or further their education, I'm sorry. Even though it's hard on them, we still, you know, encourage them to do it. And so we decided to use some of our money. I think we started maybe a couple years ago, and we've offered $500 scholarships, and along with LSU this year, we're able to offer 1,000. So they can definitely go to our website, print out the pages, fill them out, and send them in, and we will be announcing maybe on the website on the 15th, but definitely at the walk on the 18th. We'll present it then.
What a great resource. And this is for college students.
Yes, yes. Okay. And there are certain criteria that they would have to meet in order to be chosen.
Do you know what those criteria are?
It would be like, in general terms, proof that you are a student in school. They have to, you know, show that. And that's the gist of it. The rest of it builds up around that. And, you know, just somehow prove that you are a lupus patient or a family member of a patient that has lupus, because if we don't get any children that want to submit anything that has lupus, we definitely could reach out, or will reach out to their family members as well.
You know, Dr. K, there's a significant movement that's going forward in many areas of medicine. It's called lifestyle medicine, or integrated care models. And you think maybe something like lupus, it's got such a, you know, a hardcore autoimmune origin. Is there a role for things like diet and exercise and lifestyle medicine in managing, you know, an illness as complex as lupus?
It definitely plays a part in treating lupus, because exercise always is important, not just for patients with arthritis, but everybody, because exercise releases endorphins, releases hormones in the body that make patients feel better. Most patients with lupus are depressed because they have chronic pain, they have fatigue day in and day out, and that brings their mood down. But depression is also a feature of lupus. So these patients, if they get out, exercise or work out, it definitely makes them feel better. Diet has a lot to do in terms of decreasing inflammation in the body. A lot of research is pointing towards the gut as the main or one of the triggering places for inflammation in the body. So if we watch what we put into our body, and there is hope that maybe it will decrease inflammation. So there are no definite studies done for lupus, as far as I know, but diet always has a big part to play in any chronic illness, any chronic disease.
Absolutely. And when you're talking to your patients, what sort of things do you counsel them in terms of what they should stay away from that you would consider a pro-inflammatory diet? What would you consider would be on the list of things to avoid?
So when I counsel my patients, the biggest thing I say is a healthy diet is what's important. There is no such thing with lupus per se, to my knowledge, but a healthy, well-balanced diet, limited carbohydrates or sugars in the diet is something that I advise, because many patients on prednisone gain a lot of weight, and weight gain causes a lot of other problems. So trying to cut down their weight, lose weight by limiting the carbohydrates is something I definitely advise.
Ms. Bell, from your standpoint, that one of the first things that we mentioned when we talked about your experience with lupus was, you know, you've undergone a kidney transplant, correct?
Correct.
What was that experience like for you?
Well, it was, in the beginning I was scared, but once it happened, everything just went in place. Like, I was only there 2 weeks after the transplant. And from then on, I healed and now I'm moved on with my life.
Now, were you on dialysis before you got your kidney transplant?
Yes, 6 years.
And how long had you had lupus before you had to go to dialysis before the transplant?
Maybe like 5-6 years, like before I ended. You have to wait on the transplant. So once I found out, maybe 2 or 3 years later, I was able to sign up for the transplant and then be able to get on the list. And it took maybe 6 years to for them to find me a match.
And, you know, once you got your transplanted kidney, how did that change your life? What changed? And obviously, you're not going to dialysis 3 times a week anymore.
Right. So. Actually, I did peritoneal where I did it at home.
Okay.
So it changed a lot. I didn't have to stay in the house. You know, I didn't have to be at home at a certain time to do my treatment.
Right.
Now I can go and come as I please. I feel wonderful. On dialysis, you're always drained. You can't do anything, but now I'm able to just go free.
Do you know where your kidney came from?
Yes. Once it was over, they give you an option to write the family, and they don't give us the address or anything. We give them the letter to send to the family, and if the family responds, then you're able to communicate with the family. But I got it from a 3-year-old. He lived in Texas. His name was Jackson.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yes.
Dr. K, from the standpoint of, you know, working with patients who have had a transplant, what is the risk of that, you know, this brand new kidney being affected by the disease as well?
There is always a risk of the transplanted kidney to be affected by the disease, especially if the disease is not controlled or the disease is active at the time that they get the transplant. But as long as patients who've gotten their transplant follow up closely with their rheumatologist and their transplant doctors, take the medication to prevent a rejection, the transplant medication. Some of those medicines are similar to what we use to treat lupus, so it keeps lupus under control. So as long as you follow the precautions, see your doctor regularly, take your medication, hopefully the transplanted kidney should be safe.
Well, I would like to thank the three of you so much for joining us tonight on Health Matters. It's been a wonderful discussion. Ms. Livette Bell, thank you so much for being here. Ms. Rolanda Hewitt, thank you for being here. Dr. Katakaneni, thank you for being here. Hopefully,
thank you so much.
I did okay with
you
that.
You did great.
And I hope everybody listening enjoyed this discussion we had about lupus tonight. And as you know, Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professionals. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, its staff, or LSUS. This show will be available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Phone assistance has been provided this evening by Mr. Wally Derleth, Tim Snell, and Mr. Henry Edwards. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us right here next Thursday for Health Matters once again. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening.